are going to give you 5 minutes at the end of the service in case you need to go use the restroom, in case you're just so famished from being in here for an hour that you need to get an apple or something to eat. But 5 minutes is it. You go out, use the restroom, come back, and then we're going to spend the remainder of that time in prayer for Adventure Week. All right. Judges, congratulations. If you're here today, you made it to the end of the book. Almost. Today, we actually have three chapters we've got to get through. The final story of Judges takes place over the course of three whole chapters. But here's where we've been so far in the book. The person we should want leading us is God. This sounds like a no-brainer, but as we have seen through the book of Judges, it not always is. So they continually keep looking to human beings to be their leader. When God gives us a command, we must obey 100%. Our staying through this whole thing has been 99% obedience is 100% disobedience. When God gives commands, we need to follow them. We've seen it cycling down, and today is the bottom of the cycle. We are hitting the bottom of the barrel. It is just misery. That is all that is in store for you today in the final three chapters of Judges. Aren't you glad you chose to come? And then last week we saw that God is sovereign even when we fail. We saw that through the story of Samson, and we've seen it in the last five chapters of the book as well. So we have reached the final three chapters, and we are going to go at a lightning pace today, even faster than normal, because with three chapters, it took me 20 minutes just to read through it while rehearsing, and I only have 30 minutes total. So we're going to go really, really fast. I've cut out what I can. So you will see points where there are ellipses and there are verses, if you're following along, that we're not going to read. I encourage you to go read them on your own. Make sure that you know what I've cut out, and it should be pretty obvious why. Most times it's because they're retelling the story that they just told right above. So definitely go back and double check that. But for sake of time, we are going to go very quickly. This is the Bible Project. I love the Bible Project. In fact, our youth group has been using it for some teaching downstairs, and they basically do these overall summaries of books of the Bible. Then they'll do like the book of Judges in 15 minutes, and they'll give you actually a large amount of detail in a very short period of time as the videos actually sketch and draw, as they're telling the story, images to help you remember what's in the book. If you need a devotional, that'll take you about 2 to 3 months. But if you just watch one of these a day, it's right on Right Now Media, so you can have it for free if you're part of our church. You can watch and get a good glimpse or overview of everything that's in the Bible in about 2 to 3 months of just watching a short 15-minute video once a day. If you wanted to watch them all in one day, you could probably pull it off. But in the book of Judges, I usually watch these as I start to prepare because it gives me a good overview of the book. I thought it was interesting how they handled these last three chapters, because usually they are very detailed. They go into a lot of specific detail and give you good images, good things to think about, and tell you really comprehensively what is in a chapter or in a book of the Bible. But I noticed they did something a little different with these last three chapters, and I want to see if you can notice what's different.
The final story of the book is even worse. It's a shocking tale of sexual abuse and violence, which all leads to Israel's first civil war. It's very disturbing.
That's it. That's three chapters of the book right there, and that is how they chose to handle the last three chapters. Basically, they chickened out. Because the last three chapters of this book, take a look at the story of Samson, take a look at the story of Jephthah, and say, hold my Kool-Aid, because it gets dark. This is my final warning. I don't have to give this warning again after this week. If your kids are in here and you are not comfortable with them hearing things that are on a PG-13 level, we do have people in the fellowship hall, or we will have people in the fellowship hall ready to take care of them and watch them for the next 20 to 30 minutes as we go through these chapters. Pause for effect. Okay, here we go. Judges chapter 19. In those days, when there was no king in Israel, that should start sounding familiar. We've heard that a few times already. We're going to hear it again today. A certain Levite was sojourning in the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, who took himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. And his concubine was unfaithful to him. And she went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah. And there was some 4 months. So a couple of things real quick we need to understand about this. The first and foremost being, what is a concubine? All right. Many of us can be confused on concubine, think that it's something untoward. In this period of time, it is not. A concubine would have been very similar to a wife. It would just be a wife of lesser legal status than other wives. So as men in this period of time took multiple wives to themselves, something that God never prescribed, never endorsed, but the men were doing it, they would have their primary wife, the one who had the high legal status, and then they would have multiple other wives, oftentimes referred to as concubines. They would not have as much of the inheritance, they would not have been entitled to as many rights in the home, but they would have been viewed as wives. They would have been gone through an engagement period, they would have been brought into the home as a wife. Concubine just sets it apart legally. This concubine, so this wife of this Levite, this priest, who was unfaithful to him. So she runs, she leaves, and she goes back to her father's house for protection because she's been unfaithful to her husband. And if he decides to put her out, that means she will have no legal standing with him. Then her husband arose and went after her. So after 4 months, he's like, you know what? This isn't okay. I'm going to go after her and to speak kindly to her and to bring her back. And he had with him his servant and a couple of donkeys. And she brought him into her father's house. And when the girl's father saw him, he came with joy to meet him. And the father-in-law and the girl's father made him stay, and he remained with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and spent the night there. So right off the bat, we have not had a hero in this book in like weeks now. There's been no heroes in Judges. This is our hero for once. It's not much of one because he's kind of just doing the basic bare minimum. But at this point in Judges in Israel's history, doing the bare minimum is like heroic feats for them. He is being hospitable. We're actually going to see this twice in this story. Two different men who are hospitable. It is not a coincidence, I think, that they are both older men. It is holding up the older men, the men who knew what Israel was before and who were still choosing to live that out at this period of time, who are seen as faithful. And it's trying to show us that even in the midst of all the chaos, there were still faithful older men who were living in Israel at this period of time. So as this husband goes to redeem his unfaithful wife back to him, this father starts showing him generosity, hospitality. And on the fourth day, they arose early in the morning. So for 3 days, he's been feeding this guy. For 3 days, he's been entertaining and showing hospitality to this guy. On the fourth day, they arose early in the morning, and they prepared to go. But the girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Strengthen your heart with a morsel of bread, and after that, you may go." So the two of them sat and ate and drank together. Day four. So the girl's father said to the man, "Be pleased to spend the night and let your heart be merry." And when the man rose up to go, the father-in-law pressed him till he spent the night there again. And on the fifth day, he arose early in the morning to depart. And the girl's father said, "Strengthen your heart and wait until the day declines." So they ate, both of them. And when the father and his concubine and his servant rose up to depart, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, "Behold, now the day has waned towards evening. Please spend the night. Behold, the day draws to its close. Lodge here and stay and let your heart be merry, and tomorrow you shall arise early in the morning for your journey and go home." But the man would not spend the night. I don't know. I can't talk about my in-laws. Anyway, moving on. But this guy has been staying at this house for 5 days. And on the sixth day, this man, his father-in-law, is still showing him hospitality. He is still being kind to this man who his daughter was so afraid of that she had to run home to her father. And it's ultimately the man who has to say, "No, that's enough. I have eaten my fill. It is time for us to go." And thus begins the most perilous journey this man will ever take. See, he rose up and he departed, and he arrived opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. And he had with him a couple of saddled donkeys, and his concubine was with him. And when they were near Jebus, the day was nearly over, and the servant said to his master, "Come now, let us turn aside to the city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it. So it's being called Jebus at this point, not Jerusalem, which is interesting because in this point in history, Jerusalem should have been the capital city of Israel. But it's not. It's currently the capital city of the Jebusites because Israel is being occupied. And his master said to him, we will not turn again aside to the city of foreigners who do not belong to the people of Israel. Again, if you needed the reminder that this is not an Israelite city at this point, it is a Jebusite city. But we will pass on to Gibeah. And he said to his young man, come and let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night at Gibeah or at Ramah. So they passed on and went their way. This doesn't mean as much to us today, but to an Israelite reading this, especially at the period of time that this would have been written, this would have been odd. Why would you go past Jerusalem to go to Gibeah, of all places? Gibeah is a terrible place. Gibeah is not a place you want to be, at least in the Israelite mind, because they would have lived through what you are about to read. They would have been like, we would never go to Gibeah. Do you know the kind of crazy stuff they do in Gibeah? Gibeah is nuts. Don't go to Gibeah. And certainly, don't go past Jerusalem, the best city in the world, the place where everything good happens. Like, no, we don't do that. Like, why would you go past New York City to go to Jersey? Like, you just don't do it. And the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. And they turned aside there to go in and spend the night at Gibeah. And they went in and sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night. So you're already seeing the contrast here, right? That when he goes to his father-in-law's house, his father-in-law shows him hospitality. When he ends up in a town of Israelites who should show him the same hospitality, no one, not a single person, opens his house to this Levite who is going with his wife through the city. This would have been or should have been uncommon and unheard of. But behold, an old man, someone who remembered how it was before, was still living by the law, still knew what they were called to do, was coming from his work in the field at evening. And the man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was sojourning in Gibeah. And the men of this place were Benjaminites. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the traveler in the open square of the city, and the old man said, where are you going, and where do you come from? See, the old man recognizes him and wants to know, are you Israelite? Are you Canaanite? Where are you going? Where did you come from? And why are you sleeping out in the square? Why will no one take you into their home like they're supposed to do? So he said to him, we are passing from Bethlehem to Judah to the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim from which I have come. So he identifies himself as an Israelite and tells him we're traveling to this other city in Israel. He says, I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm going to the house of the Lord, but no one has taken me into his house. We have straw and feed for the donkeys and bread and wine for me and your female servant and the young man with your servants. There is no lack of anything. He says, we don't need anything but a place to sleep. We've got all the food we need. We've got all the feed for our animals. We are all set, but it would be really nice to have a place to stay. And the old man said, peace be to you. I will care for all your wants. Only do not spend the night in the square. So he brought him into the house and gave the donkeys feed, and they washed their feet, and they ate, and they drank. Now, I know not many of you are into horror movies, but in horror movies, there is always this trope. It is the one who gives the warning, right? Right at the beginning of the story, it's the old man, typically, who runs the gas station there in town, and they stop to get gas, and they're all ready because they're going up to the cabin in the woods, and the old man comes out and gives them the warning. Don't go up the road. It's nothing ever good happens up the road. Don't go up the road. And then they go up the road and everyone ends up dead. And that is how horror stories begin. This is your old man in this story. He's saying, please, whatever you do not want to be out after dark in Gibeah. Things go bad after dark in Gibeah. So he invites them into his house. And unlike a horror movie, they actually take him at his word and they go into his house and they stay in his house. But bad things happen after dark in Gibeah. As they were making their hearts merry, behold, the men of the city, worthless fellows, that word has cropped up a lot for us, surrounded the house, beating on the door. And they said to the old man, the master of the house, bring out the man who came into your house that we may know him. And the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said, no, my brothers, do not act wickedly. Since this man has come into my house, I'm the one who's entered, I'm showing him hospitality. Do not do this vile thing. And at this point in the mind of an Israelite, and honestly, if you grew up in the church, if you grew up going through Sunday school, this might be tickling the back of your brain too. This starts to sound a little familiar. Like, we've kind of heard this story somewhere before, right? Yeah. Well, then it says, behold, here are my virgin daughter and his concubine. I got these two other ladies in the house. Let me bring them out, violate them, and do what seems good to you. But against this man, do not do this outrageous thing. But the men would not listen to him. And if it wasn't tickling in the back of your brain before, it certainly is now. I have heard this story before. This is, and Sarah's already said it, Sodom and Gomorrah. This is where Israel is at in their history. That the nation of Israel, the Benjaminites, the beloved child, his descendants have another Israelite in their midst, and instead of showing him the hospitality and the kindness and the graciousness, they are reliving the worst city who ever existed. They are replaying the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, except without the happy ending of the city being destroyed and Lot getting away and having, like, it doesn't end as happy as that. So the men seize the concubine. This is the man, the old man who let them into their house, seized the concubine and made her go out to them. And they knew her and abused her all night until morning. And as the dawn began to break, they let her go. And as morning appeared, the woman came and fell down at the door in the man's house where her master was until it was light. So he throws out this man's wife to them. They have their way with her all night, and then they let her go. And the master rose up in the morning, and when he opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, behold, there was his concubine lying at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. He said to her, get up, let us be going. But there was no answer. And he put her on the donkey, and the man rose up and went away to his home. Our English translations do us the kindness of inserting euphemisms through this so that it is not as jarringly offensive as it would be if we read it. Things like, they knew her. They wanted to know him. Or things like, but there was no answer. She's dead. She died throughout the night. They injured her so badly that she was able to crawl back to the house, but she died on the threshold before anybody could come help her. So the man picks up her body, puts it on his donkey, and goes home. And when he entered his house, he took a knife, and taking hold of his concubine, he divided her limb by limb into 12 pieces and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. And all who saw it said, such a thing has never happened or been seen from the day that the people of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak. This section has confused more people going through Judges than probably any other. If someone wants to find the verses that'll really stump the pastor and make him uncomfortable having that, why in the world does this happen? This happens to make you sick to your stomach. This happens to make you realize just how bad things are in this nation of Israel. The nation of Israel has gone so bad that they are reenacting Sodom and Gomorrah. And what the Levite here is doing in this process of cutting up his wife and sending her to the 12 tribes is he is trying to have that same effect on his brothers and sisters in the nation of Israel. He's saying, wake up. We are not in a good place. Things here are not going well. We have strayed from God. Such a thing like this, what has just happened to my wife, has never happened before in Israel. We are as bad as we've ever been. Consider it. Think about it. Take counsel. And then do something about it. Saying we are in a terrible place as a nation. We need to do something about it. And to their credit, Israel does. It says, all the people of Israel came out. This is how chapter 20 begins. From Dan, Beersheba, including the land of Gilead, on the other side of the Jordan River. And the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah. They come together as a nation. And the chiefs of all the people of all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 men on foot that drew the sword. This is just 400,000 just of the soldiers show up to say, this, you are right, Mr. Levite. This is not okay. We need to do something about it. And they show up 400,000 men strong. And the people of Israel said, tell us. These are the ones who were summoned to the Levite. They said, tell us, how did this evil happen? And you see, I've cut something out here. That something is the Levite telling the story we just read. So it's just him telling the story almost verbatim of what we just read. And as he finishes telling the story, he says, behold, you people of Israel, all of you, give your advice and counsel here. He's like, you have now heard what happened. You heard why I did this thing. You've heard why I've called you all here together. I need your advice. Where are we going from here? What are we going to do next? And all the people arose as one man, saying, none of us will go to his tent, and none of us will return to his house. But now this is what we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot, and we will take 10 men of 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel, and 100 of 1,000 and 1,000 of 10,000 to bring provisions for the people, that when they come, they may repay Gibeah of Benjamin for all the outrage that they have committed in Israel. So what they said is, we are going to go deal justice. We're going to take 10% of those who showed up, which of 400,000, that would be 4,000-ish, 40,000. I can do math, 40,000. 40,000 with them to go deal justice for this woman who has been killed. And they're going to go to Gibeah of Benjamin and deal out justice for the outrage. So the tribes of Israel sent men through all the tribe of Benjamin, saying, what evil is this that has taken place among you? Now, therefore, give up the man, the worthless fellows in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and purge evil from Israel. But the Benjaminites would not listen to the voice of their brothers, the people of Israel. So they show up and say, look, we don't need to wipe you all out. We don't need to do war with you. Just give us the men who did the thing. We will only punish the men who did the thing. This is fair. This is right. And they're dealing with them the way that the law would have commanded they deal with them. For the crimes that they committed, the sins that they committed against God, they should be put to death. That's what they were going to do. Then the people of Benjamin, bear in mind again, the tribe of Benjamin, these are Israelites. There are no Philistines in this story. There are no Canaanites in this story. These are Israelites. These are Israelite brothers and sisters. This is, I mean, the modern equivalent would be church against church. This is internal conflict. The people of Benjamin came together out of the cities of Gibeah to go out to battle against the people of Israel. And the people of Benjamin mustered out of their cities on that day 26,000 men who drew the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who mustered 700 chosen men. So 26,700 going up against about 40,000. And the people of Benjamin came together out of the cities of Gibeah to do battle against Israel. Israel is coming together to do battle against Israel. They are in full-on civil war. The people of Israel arose and went up to Bethel and inquired of God, who shall go up first for us to fight against the people of Benjamin? And the Lord said, Judah shall go up first. And the people of Israel rose in the morning and encamped against Gibeah. And the men of Israel went out to fight against Benjamin, and the men of Israel drew up in the battle line against them at Gibeah. So they're at Gibeah, where this crime took place, and they're going to civil war with one another. And they go to God and they say, who should lead us? This is one of the first smart things they've done in a long time. They went to God first, and God gave them an answer. Granted, it's an answer they should have already known, but we see when they turn and they go to God and ask, God shows up and God actually answers their prayer and tells them, Judah. Judah is the tribe that the kings come out of. Judah should have been the first to go to war. Judah should have been the first in line. So that's what God tells them. And the people of Benjamin came out of Gibeah and destroyed on that day 22,000 men of the Israelites. But the people, the men of Israel, took courage and again formed the battle line, the same place where they had formed it the first day. And the people of Israel went up and wept before the Lord until the evening. And they inquired of the Lord, shall we again draw near to fight against our brothers, the people of Benjamin? And the Lord said, go up against them. So they suffer a massive defeat. Then they reform the lines. They call for more help. They have more people come in. They drop again. And again, they do the smart thing. They go to God and they say, God, we lost terribly yesterday. Do you really want us to go up again? And he says, yes, I want you to go up again. So they do. So the people of Israel came near against the people of Benjamin on the second day. And Benjamin went against them out of Gibeah on the second day and destroyed 18,000 men of the people of Israel. All these were men who drew the sword. And all the people of Israel, the whole army, went up and came to Bethel and wept. They sat there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. They're confused, right? We keep asking God if we're supposed to do this. He keeps telling us, yes, we're doing what we're supposed to do, and yet we keep failing. What is going on? And the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, saying, shall we go out once more to battle against our brothers and the people of Benjamin, or shall we cease? And the Lord said, go up, for tomorrow I will give them into your hand. They are given the command for the third time. Yes, go up tomorrow. I will deliver them. He says, I'm going to let you win tomorrow. I'm going to be the source of your win tomorrow. And in Israel's great way, they were so close, like 95% of the way there. So Israel set men there in ambush around Gibeah. It's like 95% obedience. He says, go up the same way you've done before. And they're like, okay, we will go up against them, but this time we're going to do it differently. We're going to set men in ambush around Gibeah. So the people of Israel went up against the people of Benjamin on the third day and set themselves in array against Gibeah as at other times. And when the people of Benjamin went out against the people and were drawn away from the city. So they're set up to do war. They've got another group ready to ambush. The men of Gibeah, the men of Benjamin come up to do battle. And as a result, they leave the city undefended. And the people of Benjamin said, they are routed before us as at the first. But the people of Israel said, let us flee and draw them away from the city to the highways. And all the men of Israel rose up out of their place and set themselves in array at Baal Tamar. And the men of Israel who were in ambush rushed out against that place from Meragibah. And there came out again, and there came against Gibeah 10,000 chosen men out of Israel, and the battle was hard. But the Benjaminites did not know that disaster was close upon them. And the Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel, and the people of Israel destroyed 25,100 men of Benjamin on that day. All of these were men who drew the sword. So the people of Benjamin saw that they were defeated. And the men of Israel gave ground to Benjamin because they trusted the men in ambush whom they had set against Gibeah. Up until this point, it's only been men who drew the sword who have died. And the men who were in ambush hurried and rushed against Gibeah. The men in ambush moved out and struck all the city with the edge of the sword. And now the appointed signal between the men of Israel and the men of the main ambush was that when they made a great cloud of smoke rise up out of the city, the men of Israel should turn and battle. So they've come back around to the undefended city now, and these ambushers are going to wipe out the city. It says, now Benjamin had begun to strike and kill about 30 men of Israel. Not too many today, but they were feeling like they were reestablishing the pattern. They're going to win again. And they said, surely they are defeated before us, as in the first battle. But when the signal began to rise out of the city in a column of smoke, the Benjamites looked behind them, and behold, the whole city went up in smoke to heaven. And the men of Israel turned, and the men of Benjamin were dismayed, for they saw their disaster was close behind them. So while the men are out at battle, the Israelites, the ones that they set in ambush, the way that God had not commanded them to go to battle, sneak around back and destroy the city, killing everybody in the city. Therefore, they turned in their backs before the men of Israel in the direction of the wilderness, but the battle overtook them, and those who came out of the cities were destroying them in their midst. Surrounding the Benjamites, they pursued them and trod them down from Noah to as far as the opposite Gibeah on the east. Basically, the Israelites wipe out the tribe of Benjamin. They have a few men left, but almost everything else is completely and utterly destroyed because of the actions of these few worthless men. And unfortunately, because they didn't go about it the way that God had prescribed it, they end up leaving themselves with yet another problem as a result. It says, now the men of Israel had sworn at Mitzpah, no one of us shall give his daughter in marriage to Benjamin. And the people came to Bethel and sat there until evening before God. And they lifted up their voices and wept bitterly. And they said, O Lord God of Israel, why has this happened in Israel that today we should be one tribe lacking in Israel? They go and they weep and they cry because they have wiped out Benjamin and because they had taken this oath that no one was going to be allowed to give their daughters in marriage to Benjamin. So Benjamin had no wives left of their own. They had no women left of their own. And they couldn't get wives from anywhere else in Israel. So basically, if they were going to follow the law, that meant the tribe of Benjamin is donezo. They are gone. And that causes great pain in Israel to think that they're going to go from 12 tribes to 11 tribes. They're going to lose an entire tribe as a result of the way that they chose to do battle. And the next day, the people rose early and built an altar and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. And the people of Israel said, which of all the tribes of Israel did not come up to the assembly of the Lord? For they had taken a great oath concerning him who did not come to the Lord at Mitzpah, saying, he shall surely be put to death. So they start actually devising this plan for this way that they're going to fix the problem that they themselves caused through their disobedience. Right? And the people of Israel had compassion for Benjamin, their brother, and said, one tribe is cut off from Israel this day. What shall we do for wives for those who are left? Since we have sworn by our Lord that we will not give them any of our daughters for wives. And he said, what one is there of the tribes of Israel that did not come up to Mitzpah? Who didn't come when we went to do battle? Who didn't come up as part of that? And behold, no one had come up from the camp at Jabesh-Gilead to the assembly. For when the people were mustered, behold, not one of the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead was there. Hey, there was this group. When we went to war, they didn't show up. And we had all taken an oath that said anybody who didn't show up, they were going to die. So I think I know where we might go find ourselves some wives for this. Like, there's no, like, God is not being consulted here. They are coming up with their own solution to the problem that they caused through their disobedience. So the congregation sent 12,000 of their bravest men there and commanded them, go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead with the edge of the sword. Also, the women and the little ones. This is what you shall do. Every male and every woman that has lain with a male, you shall devote to destruction. So every guy in the city, kill him. All the kids, kill him. And any of the married women, kill them too. Which will leave only unmarried women. And they found amongst the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man by lying with him. And they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is the land of Canaan. Their solution to the problem that they caused is let's go kidnap 400 young girls, and that's how we're going to fix this problem. And, you know, since we're acting like Canaanites anyway, let's take them to the land of Canaan instead of bringing them back to our house. Because they absolutely are not going about these things in a God-honoring, God-fearing kind of way. They are just trying to fix the problem that they caused. And then the whole congregation sent word to the people of Benjamin who were with them at the Rock of Rimmon and proclaimed peace to them. And Benjamin returned at that time. And they gave them the women whom they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh-Gilead. But they were not enough for them. There's some debate as to whether that's not enough, like, quantity-wise because there were more men of Benjamin, or not enough because the Benjaminites wanted more in order to make peace. Either way, not enough. And the people had compassion on Benjamin because the Lord had made a breach in the tribes of Israel. So because it was the result of a civil war, they're trying to show compassion to Benjamin. They're going to try to figure this out. Why there's not enough wives, we need to go get more wives still. So the elders of the congregation said, what shall we do for wives for those who are left, since the women are destroyed out of Benjamin? And they said, there must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe may not be blotted out from Israel. We're still not there. We still need to find more. So how are we going to do that? Yet we cannot give them wives from our own daughters. We've already established that. For the people of Israel had sworn, cursed be he who gives a wife to Benjamin. So they said, behold, there is a yearly feast at the Lord of Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Lebanon. They said every year they hold this party, this feast in Shiloh, which we just established, Canaanite city. Who lives in Canaanite city? Canaanites. Who are Israelites not supposed to marry? Canaanites. So we're going to go up to this Canaanite city where Canaanites live because we think we figured out a way to find wives who will end up being Canaanites. And they commanded the people of Benjamin, saying, go and lie in ambush in the vineyards and watch. If the daughters of Shiloh, Canaanites, come out to dance in the dances, then come out of the vineyards and snatch each man his wife from the daughters of Shiloh and go to the land of Benjamin. Like, look, you're going to go to the Canaanite city. They're going to be drunk. They're going to come wandering out into the field to go to the dance. When they do, just take them. They're your wives now. Just, this is not good people kind of stuff. This is terrible. And when their fathers or their brothers come to complain to us, say, hey, that's not cool. You just took our women. Not okay. We will say to them, grant them graciously to us, because we did not take for each man of them his wife in battle, neither did you give them to us, else you would now be guilty. So it's basically, look, when they get mad and come up to say, hey, why did you just take our wives? Why did you just take our daughters? Why did you just take these women and just kidnap them like that? We'll say, look, you should just give them to us and be gracious and be grateful to us that we took them the way we did, because the other option was we were going to come in and kill you. And if we had done that, you wouldn't even be here to complain. So don't you love us now? Don't you love the fact that we did this great thing for you? We didn't kill you? Yay. And we saved you the hassle of giving them to us. Like, we could have threatened you could give them to us, but then you would have been guilty, because then you would have given your wives to the Benjaminites. And we said anybody who gave their wives to the Benjaminites, they'd have to be killed. So because we stole them, we don't have to kill you. Yay. These are terrible people. And the people of Benjamin did so and took their wives according to their number from the dancers that they carried off. And they went and returned to the inheritance and rebuilt the towns. They lived and lived in them. And the people of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family. And they went out from there, every man to his inheritance. And in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And this is where the book ends. This is the final verse. This is the final thought that the author of Judges wanted you to have in your brain. When men do what men think is right, when women do what women think is right, when people do what people think is right in their own eyes, this is the result. It should make you sick to your stomach. It should make you angry. I think Pat said last week in Pastor of Leadership, he said, when I read this the first time, I was angry and uncomfortable. And I said, exactly. That is exactly how you should feel at this point in the book. And there was every part of me wanted to just leave it there. But I realized that's not fair, because we are not going to be moving forward in the Old Testament again till next year. And I didn't want to leave you hanging on this note for a year. So I want to show you what the very next line in Scripture is. It's Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. And in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. And if you remember back a few weeks, it's actually a couple months ago now, we actually did the story of Ruth in 1 week. And we looked at this story that takes place in the time of the judges. So likely, Judges, Ruth, and at least 1 and 2 Samuel had the same author. The same guy wrote this story. So they really could be viewed as a trilogy of books. And what he's saying is, in the time of the judges, right in the middle of all this terrible, horrible, ridiculously bad, sick to your stomach, angry and uncomfortable stuff, in those days when everything was going wrong, the story of Ruth takes place. And if you remember back to the story of Ruth, where it begins is Naomi goes with her family, loses her family, meets this Moabite woman who marries one of her sons, comes back, and it's this story of Ruth being redeemed by her kinsman redeemer, Boaz, who is the Christ figure in the story. And at the end of the book, the story of Ruth, where the story of Ruth ends, is with Ruth being established as the grandmother of David. So in this time where there were no kings in Israel and everyone was doing it right in their own eyes, right in the middle of no king chaos, God raises up Ruth, who's going to give birth to a man who is after God's own heart, who is going to be the king to lead Israel out of this chaos and back to God-fearing, God-honoring ways where they worship the God and finally realize the peace that God had always intended. So right in the middle of all of this, God is still the king. Just a little bit of hope that that is the next line in scripture right after, in those days in Israel, there was no king and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So what? So what does this all mean to us today? One, when tragic things happen, we should not blame God. I know that it is easy to say, God, if God is all powerful, why do bad things still happen? If God is good, why do bad things happen? Well, because God isn't the one doing the bad things. It's men and women, people who make the choice to rebel against what God has called us to do, to choose sin over God's plan for our lives. And when those things happen, we should look to the actual culprit, oftentimes the person staring back at us in the mirror. So then sin will always take us farther than we want to go. Sin will always cost us, keep us longer than we're willing to stay, and cost us more than we're willing to pay. It's an old cliche, but it is absolutely true. We see it in the nation of Israel, and we see it in our own lives. Thinking, I can just do this one thing and I'll be okay, will never work out in your favor. Sin will always take you further than you want to go. You will always end up doing more than you were willing to do in that bargain. It will always keep you longer than you're willing to stay. It is addictive, and it will get its claws in you, and it will not let you go, and it will cost you more than you were willing to pay. Don't try to bargain with sin. But even in the worst of it, even when everything is going wrong, even when I get nothing right, God remains faithful. We see it in the old men in this story today. We see it in the fact that God, right in the middle of that, raises up Ruth, who would lead to David, and the fact that David ultimately leads to Jesus. God remains faithful. We see it in the prodigal son, and we see it in our own lives. Because God has good plans. Ultimately, that's all we need to do. And that is the ultimate so what from the book of Judges. God has good plans. And in spite of our rebellion, in spite of our refusal to submit ourselves to those good plans, the only thing we have to do to make things right, to stop this cycle of apostasy, the pursuit of evil, is turn and walk back to the God who has remained faithful through it all. To shift and say, I got everything wrong, but God is still right. All I need to do is turn and start following him again. Let's pray. God, I thank you that so far in my life I have not had to walk through what Israel had to walk through. But God, I know that I am no better a person than they are. As much as I beat up on them as I preach, I am just as evil a person. God, because we are all equally broken. We have all equally sinned in your eyes. We need you. So, Father, I pray that at the end of this, we will not be left with depression and frustration and anger and uncomfortableness. But rather, we can walk out of here today rejoicing in the fact that you are still God. You are still good. You are still merciful. And you're still here. I thank you, and I pray in your son's name. Amen.